This is the second in our discussion of our hymnody in the series on our corporate worship, and looking forward to surveying some things this morning that hopefully will be helpful to us. We're essentially attempting to answer the question in these two sessions, why do we sing what we sing at Bethany Bible Church? Under Pastor Stike's leadership, we draw from a particular tradition, from a particular line of development of hymnody. And so we're seeking to answer the question, why do we do that? Why has Pastor and his oversight of our worship led us to draw from that tradition as opposed to other traditions? Last week, we focused on this subject from the perspective of form. And if you recall, we talked about how form shapes the content. And that is really part of the criteria that we use in choosing our hymnody, is the form of the hymns that we sing, shaping the content to express biblical truth in the right way and the right kinds of affections for expression to the Lord. This week, we're gonna tackle our subject from the perspective of history. And don't let that scare you. We're going to use a lot of musical examples, a lot of listening examples, a lot of what I think are very interesting perspectives as the history develops. But let me explain to you first why I think that it's important that we do this. Let me offer this caveat at the beginning here. As I was putting together this presentation, I had a lot of quotes and supporting kinds of quotations. And for sake of time, I had to remove a lot of them just for sake of time. But I do, on our church website, when the audio is posted, they'll also post the notes for this session. And I have a lot of quotes in there that I won't be doing today, a lot of footnotes. So if you're interested in support for some of the statements that are made today, let me encourage you to go on the website and download those notes, because you'll be able to then see some of that support there that I really can't do for sake of time today. Let me explain to you why I think it's important that we kind of survey this morning the history of the development of hymnody over time. On the wall in my study, I have three portraits. All three of these are theologians who are also heavily involved with music and specifically hymnody. The three portraits that I have are Martin Luther, Johann Sebastian Bach, and Isaac Watts. All three of these men fought their battles in their day in defense of high standards for worship music. And all three of them had their share of controversy. And all three are commonly compared to modern worship controversies, usually in defense of contemporary worship. For instance, you'll hear an argument like this. Someone might say, see, people in their day were afraid of new music, and these men introduced new music, and so why shouldn't we today? You'll hear arguments like that. Or perhaps you've heard this one. Luther used bar tunes, Bach borrowed from secular music, and Watts broke the mold by writing new songs, so why shouldn't we do the same? I've heard a lot of different arguments, even further from these men, things like this. The Israelites used the same music as cultures around them, so why shouldn't we? The organ was once just as controversial as the electric guitar is today. Mozart was a terrible man. How can we say that his music is good? Handel's Messiah was popular in his day, just like pop music is in our day. Didn't Wesley say, why should the devil have all the good music? Or some people attribute that to Luther. Have you heard arguments like that? Okay, those are all arguments based in history. And usually such assertions are based in ignorance or really a misunderstanding of the actual facts. And they really serve to kind of cloud and confuse the discussion even further. And so it's for this reason that I think it's important for us today to take some time and survey the development of our hymnody throughout history. And we're just going to be scratching the surface. On the way here, I was saying, oh, I wish I could have included that. I wish I could have included that. We're really skimming the surface here, but I think it will be helpful for all of us to consider the tradition that we draw from as a church and why we do so. Now, let's talk about culture first. In last week, we discussed the importance of form in our hymnody and the fact that form shapes content. But the second important truth about form that we need to realize is that forms don't just appear out of nothing. Forms are cultivated over long spans of time, similar to how bacteria is grown in an environment. It's a culture. That's where we get that term. No one gets up one morning and says, I think I'll invent a new musical form today. We draw from what has come before, and we develop it, and we move forward. That's what a culture is. A cultural form is the natural product of the environment in which it was nurtured. And so all cultural forms, then, are expressions of value systems, of worldviews, of religious beliefs. This means that whatever we create in our time and in our culture is always built on something that has come before. We're always using materials and blueprints from people who've come before us. The question is, what are we going to draw from as we move forward? It's like when someone builds a house. If someone builds a house for the first time, they use a blueprint. Nobody just wakes up one morning having no experience building a house and says, I think I'll build a house today. Okay? That's the foolish man who builds it on sand. Okay? We all start with the blueprint, and then after someone has worked with blueprints over time, learned how it works, learned what makes a sound structure, then maybe he can draw his own blueprints or even work without a blueprint. But he has to start with something first, and that something was passed on to him by someone else. Or it's like baking a cake. Someone who's baking a cake for the first time is going to use a recipe. And then after time, when they learn what makes a good cake, they maybe can make their own recipe or go without a recipe. But you have to start with a recipe, and that is given to you from someone else. The same is true for tradition. Everybody has a tradition. Everybody works with a tradition. The question is, what blueprint are we going to use? Where are we going to get it from? And this is why it's absolutely essential that we understand how form has developed and been cultivated throughout history, and specifically how the forms of our hymns have been nurtured within what I'm going to call the Judeo-Christian tradition. That is the tradition that has moved from Israel through the early church and up until today. How have our hymns developed through that tradition? We have at our fingertips such a rich heritage of cultural forms that have grown up within biblical value systems of first Judaism and then biblical Christianity. And they were forms that were cultivated with the goal of expressing biblical values. We have such a rich heritage, and it's important for us to know how that developed. And what I'm going to suggest in this session is that if we want to conserve true biblical worship, if we want to worship how Pastor has laid out in his introductory sessions, then we need to continue and preserve and draw from that Judeo-Christian tradition when choosing our hymnody. Now, what is that tradition? Is there even such a thing? That's where we're going to spend most of our time. How have hymns developed over the course of history, and where are we today? Well, let's start at the very beginning. The first mention of music in the Bible is in Genesis 4. Verses 17 through 21 list Cain's descendants, and specifically those who begin the development of various cultural and social skills. So we find, for instance, that Jabal was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. Tubal-Cain was the forger of all instruments of bronze and silver. And Jubal was the father of all those who play lyre and pipe. So he was the father of instrumental music. Now, there's an important truth in this revelation in Genesis chapter 4. Man creates music. Man nurtures cultural forms. Now, it's true that music existed before people did. For instance, we find in Job 38:7 that the morning stars sang together when God created the earth. That could be angels, that could be literal stars, but music as an idea existed before people. So music in and of itself is something that God created and gifted to man. But songs are created by people, not by God. God doesn't write songs and give them to us. People write songs. And ever since the fall of mankind, anything that people create is potentially an expression of sin. Pastor talked about this in his first session. Anything that comes as a product of human culture may or may not be an expression of something that is good or evil. In fact, just after in Genesis 4 we read that Jubal was the father of music, we find the first recorded song in Scripture. And this song is not an expression of praise, and it's not even just a wholesome folk song. It's a song of vengeance by Jubal's father, Lamech. I won't read it here for you for sake of time, but the first example of a song in the scripture is one that expresses something not good. This only goes to demonstrate why we need to evaluate all music. Music is human expression, and therefore can be an expression of good or evil. Now, let's move to Old Testament Hebrew hymns. Now remember, at this point, as I said last week, I'm just using the word hymn very broadly to describe any kind of sacred congregational song. So for them, it was obviously what we would call psalms, but I'm going to use the word hymn here. We can't consider the development of the church's hymnody without first considering the music of the Old Testament Hebrews. Christianity began, of course, as an offshoot of faithful Judaism, especially in its worship forms, as we'll see. And so if we understand the roots of Hebrew music, that will help us to understand the hymnody of the church. Now, a couple things that we need to remember as we discuss the music of the Hebrews. First, we need to be careful not to transplant our perception of Jewish music today and simply assume that David's music sounded exactly the same. Okay? Hebrew music in the Old Testament was very different from what we know as Jewish music today. Jewish music today is really a complex mix of a whole lot of things. It's a mix of Western influences, because remember, the Jews were spread all over the world for a good period of time. So it's a mix of Western music, Arabic traditions, and then certainly there's some Jewish folk influences in there too. But it's really a complex mix. And usually our perception of Jewish music today is filtered through pop music or Hollywood. It's their perception of Jewish music. So get out of your mind what you think from maybe movies you've watched of what Jewish music sounds like. We're gonna look at what Jewish music in the Hebrew times sounded like in a moment. The other important factor is this. We must remember that Israel was a theocracy. In other words, their religion, their politics, their social life, it was all intertwined. There wasn't any kind of separation of church and state like we know today. This is important because all of the music, not all of the music that's recorded for us in the Old Testament, was intended for corporate worship. Even if it's about God, it might not be intended for corporate worship because God permeated everything in Hebrew life. So in the Old Testament, we find war songs, work songs, love songs, and songs for entertainment. There's all those different kinds of songs, and they probably have some reference to God in them because Israel was a theocracy, but they're not necessarily intended for worship. So as we evaluate the hymnody of the Hebrews, we're limiting ourselves to those songs that were intended to be part of corporate worship as we look at this. Now, contrary to popular opinion, we do have a fairly accurate idea of what Hebrew hymns would have sounded like. I won't go into all the research and how we've come to these conclusions, but scholars have deciphered certain marks in the Hebrew scriptures themselves. They've done historical research, archaeological research, and they have been able to reproduce tunes that were used in the Hebrew worship. I'll give you one example here. Here, if you can see this, this is an example using our modern notation of a setting of Psalm 113. And very likely, this was exactly what it sounded like in Hebrew worship. I'm actually going to play this for you and let you listen to it. So bring to your mind what you think Jewish music sounded like, okay? And based on study of the scriptures and study of history and archaeology and all these things, this is what scholars are pretty confident this psalm would have sounded like in the temple worship of the day.
Alleluia, alleluia, Adonai, alleluia, Shem Adonai, Yehi Shem Adonai, Nevona, Meata, Adonai.
So it fits somewhat of what we think of Eastern music, right? But maybe not quite what Hollywood's portrayal of Jewish music is. Okay, that is fairly consistent with how most of their music in the temple sounded. Now, there are several characteristics to note when we consider the tunes, the instruments, and the character of Hebrew hymnody. As we look in the scriptures, the instruments they use, and the descriptions of worship, and as we consider some of these reproductions of what it sounded like, there are some characteristics that really rise to the surface. First, Hebrew hymns were text-driven. It was very much centered around the words, the text. Second, Hebrew hymns were modest. Their melodies are simple and constrained, and the instruments that are listed for us in the Old Testament were of modest character, especially during vocal singing. For example, we know that while louder instruments like trumpets were used to signal various events in their social life or even in worship, they were used to signal the beginning of certain events. Whenever the Levites sang in corporate worship, they were always accompanied only by softer instruments that would not cover up the words. That's very interesting. And even things like trumpets are not the loud brassy kinds of trumpets that we know today. They didn't have the brass instruments back then. They were more of a hollow, softer sound. One trumpet today could probably overpower a whole ensemble of trumpets in their days. Even their percussion was modest. In fact, only one pair of cymbals was permitted in their worship. And very likely, the cymbals that they used was used similar to how a conductor uses a baton today. It was used to keep the ensemble together. It wasn't used to mark out a steady rhythm like percussion is used today, because they did not have steady rhythm back then. It was a very free rhythm, as you could hear in that song. There wasn't a steady 1, 2, 3, 4 like we have in our music today. It was much different. It was much freer. Even their singing was modest. It was not loud and noisy compared to maybe what popular belief might be today. Their music was quite modest. Their singing was quite modest, as you can hear in that reproduction. Many people have assumed that Hebrew music was loud and raucous because they assumed that it was similar to other Middle Eastern music in the day. But the final characteristic here, I think, will clear up this misconception. The third characteristic is that their hymnody was very clearly distinct from the pagan musical forms of the day. The first two qualities that we have featured here, the text-driven and the modest, evidence this already right away. I have here a lengthy quote that I'm not going to read, but his point here is that the pagan music of the day was not text-driven by any stretch of the imagination. It was very loud and was intended to stir up the group into a frenzy. That was the pagan music, and therefore it was not modest at all, contrary to Hebrew music. I want to give you another listening example here. This is an example of ancient Egyptian music based on scraps of musical notation that they found from the day. This is very likely the kind of music the Hebrews would have been familiar with during their time of Egypt. And I want you to notice how different this is from what we listened to a moment ago. Particular instruments they used, particular rhythms, and this, I won't play the whole thing, but it works faster and faster and works into kind of a frenzy, and this was all fit with their worship. They wanted to work themselves into a kind of ecstatic state. So I only do that to show you the distinction. The Hebrew music was distinct from that on purpose. It was distinct from the pagan forms that surrounded them in their time. Now, during the golden age of Israel, the worship music, because Israel was a theocracy, would have filtered down. Those forms that were developed within their worship would have filtered down and affected other aspects of their culture as well. So the non-sacred music, even though it was sacred because they were a theocracy, but the war songs, the work songs, the love songs, all of these different forms of culture really sounded all very similar. And we can even see that in the poetic forms that we find in the Old Testament. They all look the same. The difference is their subject matter. But the forms are the same. And as I mentioned, when it came to pagan culture, there was very much a resistance of any influence by paganism. Now, when Israel was taken captive in 586 BC, things changed. They didn't have the active development of their cultural forms anymore because they were captive. But nevertheless, they still resisted pagan influence. And with no temple, the Hebrews worshipped in synagogues. And since instruments were associated with a temple, in synagogue worship, no instruments at all were used. So it was even really even more modest and restrained than what they would have had in the temple. Now, what do we do with this understanding of the Hebrew worship? Should we go back and sing their tunes exactly how they did? Not at all. Of course not. Cultures do develop over time. We're going to see how culture has moved and followed this tradition. But, of course, we do sing many of the texts that they sing. Even maybe you may not even realize it. For instance, many of the hymns of Isaac Watts are actually paraphrases of various psalms. For instance, O God, our help in ages past is a paraphrase of Psalm 90. Jesus shall reign is a paraphrase of Psalm 72. Joy to the world is a paraphrase of Psalm 98. So we still draw from this tradition, if not tunes, for sure, texts. What about the early church now? The hymnody of the early church was a natural extension of Hebrew hymnody. The early church, as you know, continued to worship in synagogues, and they just took the worship forms that they enjoyed there, and they brought them into the church. And then they added hymns about Christ as well. So we can expect in the hymnody of the early church that they had the same general characteristics. Early church hymns were text-driven, they were modest, and they were distinct from the pagan culture around them. And then they continued to nurture those forms that they inherited in Jewish worship. The only change that they probably made was addition of text about Jesus Christ, because that certainly was something different than what the Jews would have done. And we have some of those texts recorded for us in the New Testament. Ephesians 1, Philippians 2, a lot of portions of the Greek New Testament are written in poetic form and were very likely the earliest hymns of the church. Now, as the church began to spread after the closing of the New Testament canon, churches continued to nurture the forms that had been handed down to them, and these three characteristics continued. And I want to show you this. First, early church hymns continued to be text-driven. Church leaders continued to praise the Psalms, but they also wrote new texts that were filled with serious doctrinal truth. The text was the center. Let me just give you an example here of a hymn by Ignatius. He lived from around 35 to 107. This is the earliest scrap of hymnody that we have. I won't read it for you here, but a hymn about Christ, rich in its doctrine, text-driven. Their musical forms were borrowed from Hebrew forms and continued the tradition. They very likely sang the very same kinds of tunes in the early church. Once we get to this period, we call it plain chant. It's a simple, it's one step above natural intonation of the voice, as we talked about last week. Very simple, very modest, which leads us to the second characteristics. They were text-driven. Early church hymns were modest. The church leaders at this time were unanimous in their warnings of what they called extravagant or passionate music. Let me give you an example. Clement of Alexandria said this, "But we must abominate extravagant music which enervates men's souls and leads them to changefulness, now mourning, then licentious, then voluptuous, then frenzied, then frantic." They were against music that just kind of stirred you up into a frenzy. They wanted music that was modest. Clement argued that the church's hymnody should employ temperate harmonies. This was universal. You read all of these early church leaders, and they're all saying the same thing. And this emphasis of, again, being text-driven and being modest was in stark contrast in the culture in which the church lived. Their music was distinct from the pagan culture. Greek and Roman culture of their time was far from benign. Here's a quote. I won't read the whole thing, but he talks about the music and the worship of the Greeks and the Romans being frenzied and ecstatic and orgiastic. That's what the culture around them was. And it, once again, the early church resisted that. I'm going to play an example for you. This is an example of early Greek music. And again, I want you to notice the kind of music that this is in contrast to what the early church would have sung as taken from the Hebrew tradition. This is early Greek music. instruments, certain percussion, certain way of working up to a frenzy again. Much different than what the early church would have used. I won't play the whole thing for you, but it works faster and faster and faster and faster again, intended to bring the people up into kind of an emotional frenzy. So once again, the church leaders were unanimous in their condemnation of the pagan musical forms. And really, I think they almost went overboard, and I'll tell you why. They even said, we're not going to use any instruments whatsoever in our worship. All of the early church fathers said this. Here's just one example from Clement, talking about we're not going to use flutes, strings, choirs, dancing, all of these things associated with the pagan worship of the day. We're just not going to use it at all. Well, why did they do that? Well, they rejected instruments altogether for two reasons. Number one, they didn't want to associate with pagan worship, and all of these things were closely associated with the pagan worship of their day. But even more importantly, they believed that the particular instruments that were used shaped the content of the songs in a certain way that didn't fit with Christian affections. Remember, when we hear flutes or these kinds of things that he's listing, it's not our modern-day flutes, nor is it the flutes that are listed in the Old Testament. These are particular instruments with particular kinds of sounds. What you heard in that example was a kind of a reeded instrument that gives a kind of seedy, kind of edgy sound. And they said, that's communicating something that we don't want in our worship. So we're just going to get rid of instruments altogether. They may have gone a little too far in that, maybe, but I think we all can understand why they did in their cultural conditions. They wanted to, for good reasons, separate themselves as far as possible from that worship. So here we find in the early church again, text-driven, modest, and distinct from pagan worship. And these characteristics weren't that way just because they were blindly following a tradition. These characteristics are biblical, are they not? Colossians 3 tells us to let the word of Christ dwell in us richly as we sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Our hymns should be text-driven. They should be modest. The New Testament warns us about feeding the flesh and feeding the passions of the flesh. Instead, we're supposed to nurture noble affections of love and joy and peace and long-suffering. And the New Testament tells us to be distinct, to not allow ourselves to be conformed to the value systems of this world. The early church hymns were text-driven and modest and distinct from paganism because it is biblical. They were following this tradition, but not blindly. They were following this tradition because this tradition communicated values that were consistent with the Word of God. Let's move now to the medieval times, which we're going to spend a lot of time on this week in music camp if you're here. When Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity in 313 at the Edict of Milan, and Christianity soon became the religion of the entire empire, the cultural conditions within which the Christian church thrived were much different now. They were actually very similar to what Israel enjoyed during its golden age. Christianity really gained prominence over all aspects of politics and social life, very similar to what Israel enjoyed. And this created an environment in which this Judeo-Christian tradition really thrived and developed. And yet the church's hymnody never departed from this direction that it had always been on since it was handed the forms from the Jewish worship. And the characteristics were the same. You're going to see these common themes. Medieval hymns were text-driven. This plain chant from the Hebrews developed into what we know as a little more refined Ambrosian chant, or you probably know of Gregorian chant. Again, sounds very similar to what they inherited from the Hebrews, with a little more refinement, a little more development, but it still gave prominence to the text. The melody followed the natural fall, rise and fall of the doctrinally rich hymn texts. Here's an example of one hymn text that we sing in our church. This is probably the oldest hymn that we sing in our congregation by Ambrose, the father of Christian hymnody. O splendor of God's glory bright, a Christological hymn. He was fighting the heresy of Arianism, and he wrote this hymn to affirm the deity of Christ. And we sing this hymn still today in our church from that long ago. Second, medieval hymns were modest. Again, church leaders were against what they called passionate music. Here's one historian who describes this, that Isidore of Pelusium warned against misusing music to arouse the passions. Basil warned against being brought down to the passions of the flesh by the pleasures of song. This was, again, universal. They warned against music that simply stirred up the physical experience or worked us up into a frenzy. Now, these church leaders were not against expression of affection to God. Remember, that's the essence of what worship is. That's not what they're talking about when they say a passion. For instance, Augustine, I won't read this whole thing, but talks about the fact that hymns help us express jubilation to the Lord when words are insufficient. When we understand truth about God, we talked about this last week, and words just don't express what our hearts are feeling. Music can help us express that. They weren't against at all expressing affection to the Lord. But as I argued last week, the music is not what elicits the response. It is an expression of the response that has already been elicited by an encounter with God in His Word. So it is God and His truth that elicits the response of the affections, and music is the language with which we express that affection. And so the early church music was modest. And then third, medieval hymns were distinct from pagan forms. Just like those who came before them, they spoke out against the pagan music of their day. Here's just one example by John Chrysostom. What can one say of the songs themselves, talking about the pagan songs around them, crammed as they are with all uncleanness, introducing monstrous amours and unlawful connections and subversions of houses and tragic scenes without ends? And he goes on and he says, you wonder where adultery and fornication and violation of marriage come? It's because of all this music around us. Once again, the argument against pagan music was more than just association, although that was certainly part of it, but an argument that was based on the fact that the music itself communicated evil messages, messages that were not consistent with the Christian affections. Now, what's interesting in this period is that because the medieval church had so much influence, and since it progressively permeated all of Western civilization, for all practical purposes, it eliminated pagan culture for the most part. Any pagan influence was pretty much eliminated. In other words, the Christian church nurtured all cultural forms. Let me see if I can picture this for you. Okay, so here we have, once again, just like in the Old Testament, the religious music, that's where all the musical and poetic forms were developed and nurtured. And that was passed down to the non-sacred high culture and the non-sacred folk culture. The subject matter would not have been necessarily sacred. It would have been about summer and family and life and love. But the forms were nurtured and developed in the church so that the music and the poetry basically all sounded the same. And this cultivation really provided a rich heritage. Now, the one unfortunate thing that happened during this time was toward the end, as the Roman church began to develop some of its heresy and errant practices, they began to get rid of congregational singing. And that was a big error, of course, and we'll see that recovered in the Reformation. But nevertheless, even though congregational singing ceased for the most part, and the clergy sang in Latin only, still, the forms that were developed were nurtured and expressed ordinate expression of Christian affections. There are many hymn texts and tunes from this time period that we still enjoy singing today. One example, both text and tune that comes from this period is Of the Father's Love Begotten. I'll just play a bit of this. I assume you know it. Sounds like Gregorian chant, right? We've kind of modernized it a little bit in our day, but it's pretty much consistent with what they would have sung in their day. Again, another rich Christological hymn. All Glory, Laud, and Honor was written during this time. All Creatures of Our God and King, Be Thou My Vision was an Irish hymn. O Sacred Head, Now Wounded, the text to that, the text to all of these, not necessarily the tunes that we sing, but the texts. And then one that you might not know, the tune that we sing to When I Survey is based on a Gregorian chant from this time. So we enjoy today, in our church, Bethany Bible Church, we enjoy singing hymns that were nurtured and cultivated and developed during this time period. hymns that were text-driven, modest, and distinct from the pagan culture. Let's move now to the Reformation. When Martin Luther sparked the Reformation with nailing of those 95 theses, he challenged the Roman Church's doctrine, and he challenged the Roman Church's practice, but he didn't worry about the musical forms. In fact, he argued that the musical forms were still good to use because those musical forms were still following that tradition that was consistent with the Scriptures. He argued for changing the text, certainly, because some of the texts of the Roman Church were now beginning to communicate errant doctrine. And he also argued that our texts should be in the spoken language of the people. He reintroduced congregational singing. So he certainly changed the texts, but he continued to use that same tradition of poetic and musical forms. And this led Luther to write what is, you know, his most famous hymn. He wrote, this is, I think, the only one where he wrote the text and the tune, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And the tune even was developed from an old Gregorian chant. That tune that he wrote was based off of the tradition that he had inherited, that he thought was still good. So once again, Reformation hymnody is text-driven. It was all about the text, communicating rich doctrine and the music supporting that text. It was also modest. Those who wrote hymn tunes wanted their music to be ordered and refined. I'll give you one example from Michael Pretorius, who wrote a lot of what we consider art music, but also some hymn tunes. He said, "Equality of measure is indeed to be preserved, lest the harmony be impaired or confused. For to sing without rule and measure is to offend God himself, who arranged all things by number, weight, and measure." So he said, it is incumbent upon us that we have ordered, modest music. John Calvin, another reformer, especially insisted that music be modest. Calvin understood the dangers of music so well that he even went even further and prohibited the use of instruments, just like the early church fathers did. We may say maybe he went a little too far, but he was just being careful. He understood how music could stir up the passions and rouse people up in unbiblical ways, and he was so afraid of that he prohibited instruments. He wasn't against instruments per se. He was a musician. He allowed instruments in the homes, for instance. But he said, when it comes to worship, I want to be careful that our music is modest, that it's not just stirring people up into frenzies. And so that's why he prohibited instrumental music. Calvin also limited to the singing of psalms only. But again, this wasn't about musical form at all. They still sang the same musical forms. The reason he limited to psalms is because he was trying to get the church back to having the Scriptures be the supreme authority, which the Roman church had lost. And so he insisted, let's just get back to the psalms, let's stick with the psalms and make sure that the Bible is our supreme authority. And therefore, psalmody really thrived in his time and with other Calvinist churches for years to follow. Now, we have here these two characteristics, the same condition that we had during the medieval church and during the golden age of Israel. There really was no pagan culture per se during this time. The church controlled high culture, controlled folk culture. And so the church really didn't have to worry very much about separating itself from pagan culture. There really wasn't a pagan culture. I'll get to that in a minute. But nevertheless, they did separate themselves because of associations sometimes with other secular music of the day. For instance, one good example of this is Martin Luther. Martin Luther, in one case, used a secular folk tune for one of his hymns. Now, as I have pictured here in this image, you can see that the form of the folk tune came down from the church anyway. So it was a good piece of music that was then recycled back to use for the hymnody. But even in that case, and this was the only time, contrary to popular belief, that Luther borrowed a folk tune for a hymnody. This was the only time he ever did it. And even then, eventually, he changed the tune because he was embarrassed that the same tune that he was singing in church, even though it was a good tune, was also being sung in the dance halls. He was embarrassed about that, not because there was anything wrong with the music, but purely because of association. And so he changed the tune. Let me use this opportunity to dispel one common myth about Martin Luther. People often argue that since Luther used bar tunes, then we should be able to use the kind of music used in bars today. I've heard that, okay? But what these people are confusing is the common medieval bar form. That's a form of poetic and musical structure that Luther used in many of his hymns. They hear bar tune and they think tune played in the tavern. Did Luther use bar tunes? Yes. But we're not talking about tavern tunes. We're talking about bar form. It's this form AAB. In other words, we have a musical line that's then repeated, AA, and another section that's in contrast to the first two. A Mighty Fortress Is Our God is an example of that. You have the same melody, and then a contrasting section. A lot of Luther's hymns are in bar form, but it has nothing to do with taverns. Okay? Now, as I said, even though no pagan culture was prominent, they still distanced themselves from secular culture when there would have been distracting associations. And I gave you that example of Luther's folk tune. Luther was also very careful to avoid what he called carnal music, music that stimulated the base passions. Even though there was not this in-your-face pagan music, there was still some folk music that was intended for the dance hall, and he thought was a little bit too driving in its arousing of the passions. And so he said, let's stay away from that. He argued that good music could wean people away from carnal and lascivious songs. And so we have this distinction from secular culture. There are other hymn writers that come later, especially in England, that follow this tradition. Writers like Isaac Watts and Charles Wesley, they're not exactly Reformation writers, but they definitely follow this tradition before what we're going to talk about in a moment. Watts, of course, the father of English hymnody. Wesley wrote lots and lots of hymns, and again, they're following in this tradition. Again, not tradition for its own sake, but following this tradition because we have to start with something. We have to have a blueprint. We have to have a recipe. And we might as well get that blueprint from other Christians who knew what they were doing. Not tradition for its own sake, but tradition because it fits with the Scriptures. Now, let me show you this chart that I think might help to picture what's happened up to this point. So far in our journey, we have witnessed an almost unbroken stream of Judeo-Christian tradition. I mean, from King David to Lutheran composer Johann Kruger in the end of the 17th century, we find a slow and steady cultivation of poetic and musical forms. Have they changed? Absolutely. Have they developed? Have they become more complex? Absolutely. But it's still following this same tradition, these same characteristics over time. There were certainly bumps in the road and many changes and many, many mistakes along the way. Yet for around 1,800 years, the quality and character of the hymnody remained consistent, text-driven, modest, and distinct from pagan culture. But something happens in the 18th century, something that changed that would forever alter this path. Really what happened, and we're going to see this, is that the people of God were once again exiled, similar to Israel. But the difference is, they didn't recognize it. So what happened in the 18th century? Well, the 18th century brought about what has come to be called the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. This was a time in which reason and science were elevated over faith. Okay, remember, during the medieval times, during the Reformation, faith, religion, Christianity was dominant. Now everything is turned on its head. Christianity doesn't matter anymore. Faith doesn't matter anymore. Only reason, only science. Abraham Kuyper said that during this time, this was the expulsion of God from practical and theoretical life. The position that the church had enjoyed as the dominant influence was over. Reason was now king. Reason was in control. What this meant for worship forms is that active cultivation of worship virtually stopped. So you can see here, during Israel, we had the worship forms developed in the church and passed down to high culture and folk culture. During their exile, that didn't happen, but they kept distinct from the pagan culture. Then once again, during the medieval and Reformation times, we have the forms developed in the church passing down to the high culture and the folk culture. But with the Enlightenment, the church loses all control. The church has no more influence. High culture basically starts to dwindle and eventually fades away because there's no moorings, there's no ethical moorings anymore. Folk culture ceases to exist, we'll see that in a moment, and pagan culture once again begins to influence and gain control. The church culture stopped because talented poets and musicians stopped writing for the church and started writing for money. So all the talented people stopped developing the forms. They continue to write noble music that had been handed down to them in the form of high culture, for instance. This is where you have guys like Mozart and later into the Romantic period. They were using forms that had been handed down to them, so they continued for a time to write good music, but eventually it faded away to where now most of high culture has no Christian values whatsoever, for the most part. There are exceptions, of course. Let me just give you some quick bullet points of what the Enlightenment did to culture's view of music. For the Enlightenment, the goal of music is to excite human passions rather than to calm them. Music provides entertainment and diversion rather than the shaping of content. The best kind of music is characterized by variety rather than order and modesty. Individuality and originality are virtues rather than cultivating a noble tradition. Music is gauged as excellent by its popular acclaim rather than its ability to shape the content. The best kind of music is natural and unlearned, according to the Enlightenment, rather than skilled and ordered. Music is purely scientific without any ethical dimension. This is when people begin to say that music is neutral. It's not good or bad. It's just there. And finally, music is really unimportant. Rather than what our tradition has said, music is that which orders men's souls. Let me read this quote by one historian that I think sums it up. Music, for that matter, all the arts, had become, with the Enlightenment, a theological orphan. In fact, no important theological movement, either in the 19th or 20th century, ever since the Enlightenment, no important theological movement has concerned itself in any profound way with the significance of harmony, order, or beauty in Christian life or worship. What happened then was people wanted to make money off this. If we're going to say the best music is popular music, the best music is that which rouses us up, well, we're going to make money off of that, and that is when pop culture comes into existence. Pop culture didn't exist before this. Pop culture is essentially a sanitized version of paganism intended to make money. That's what it is. It's expressing pagan values. It borrows from the Judeo-Christian tradition. It borrows from high culture. It borrows from folk culture, but really it's an imposter. It borrows from those things only to turn them around and make money off of them, have paganism slip in the back door without the listener knowing what has happened. So what happened with the church? Well, this left the church in a very awkward position. What are we going to do now? The church has no more cultural influence. Reason is king. Popular culture is king. Faith, it's just optional. So as the culture around the church began to plunge into sanitized paganism, the church's traditional forms became more and more weird and foreign. It didn't look like everything around it. The church was in Babylon once again, and yet the difference was that it was free to worship how it pleased. So the question became, do we continue to cultivate this Judeo-Christian tradition? If we do, we're going to become progressively more and more alienated from the culture around us. Or do we contextualize and abandon our tradition for a new one that follows the lead of pop culture? That was the choice they had to make. Do we continue this tradition and become alienated? Or do we adopt what's going on around us so that we can be relevant? And eventually, as you can imagine, they chose the latter path. The man who blazed the trail here is a man named Charles G. Finney. Okay, so we have Finney, a new line on the chart here. Finney was a revivalist who believed that you could convert people by moving them to have some kind of emotional experience. He was a Pelagian, as Pastor talked about in the first session. He believed that we could produce conversion by human means. And so he wanted to create an exciting atmosphere that led to such a conversion. And he found in pop music the perfect tool for that. He actually told his musicians, look at the advertisers of the day. Look at the music that's written to sell stuff. We want to sell the gospel, so let's copy them. And after Finney, Everything changes. What we find then is that evangelicalism as a whole breaks off of the tradition as a rule. There are exceptions, but as a rule, evangelicalism as a whole, following Finney's lead, breaks off of this tradition and begins to be influenced by pop culture. Now, in that day, it was what we would consider a pretty benign form of pop culture. I'm talking about vaudeville and Victorian songs and Let Me Call You Sweetheart and Beautiful Dreamer and Daisy Daisy and those sorts of things. Okay, so it's not as bad as hard pop that we know today. But it nevertheless was a total... Notice this chart. Notice where the arrows are pointing. Up until the Enlightenment, all of the development is coming down from Christian values. After the Enlightenment, everything is coming up from pagan values, and the church is no longer controlling the forms. The church is taking the forms from pagan culture. We're going to be out of time in a few minutes, so I don't have time to develop this very much, but the tradition that broke off, that basically followed the pop music of the day, is what has been come to be called gospel songs, for the most part. The gospel song movement began with camp meeting revivals in the 1800s. And these meetings, they wanted to create a kind of excitement. And so, won't read this whole quote, but they wanted catchy, popular kinds of tunes to make people excited about these camp meetings. Soon thereafter, the Sunday school movement took these same songs and adopted them for use for children. Because, hey, we want children to feel excited too. So, hey, these are the perfect songs to use. As these children grew up, they took those songs and they finally made their way into worship. One historian says, the same style of music appeared with somewhat more adult vernacular text 20 years later and came to be known as gospel hymns or gospel songs. It's impossible to overestimate the influence of these simple experience songs written by theological and musical amateurs and the grips they had on the general public. So this was all intended to create a kind of warm, exciting feeling. Now, that doesn't mean everything that we know of as gospel songs is like this. There are some good things that have come from the gospel song tradition. But the philosophy definitely changed. No longer was it develop these rich forms to nurture noble affections and expression of worship. Now it was, we got to get people saved, so let's use music that's exciting. That was their whole motivation. I don't have time to read this quote too, but it talks about using the popular songs of the Civil War era with their catchy melodies in order to excite the crowd. And notice that last statement there, save for the words, popular sacred music was hard to distinguish from the secular. This is much different from the characteristics that we've seen up to this point. Finney's influence continued through later revivalists, men like Moody and Sankey and Sunday and Rodehaver. They all had this desire to create an atmosphere in their congregations that was exciting, that was passionate. And in order to do so, they used the popular music of the day. Moody did not want any song that didn't produce a response. That was his goal. Sunday and Rodehaver were known in the day of being men who brought entertainment to the crowd, crowd-pleasing kinds of mannerisms. And this revivalist tradition slowly seeped into the churches, and so really, for a lot of churches, every meeting was an evangelistic revival meeting. Again, this is not to say that nothing written in the gospel song tradition is good. There's certainly a lot that's come out of it that was good, but the entire philosophy of hymnody shifted. Instead of text-driven hymns, we now had hymns centered around a catchy text and a catchy tune. Instead of modest hymns, we now had hymns whose purpose was to create excitement and energy. And instead of hymns that were distinct from pagan culture, pagan culture was now supplying the musical forms. Just one example, it's a grand thing to be a Christian. You know that song taken directly from the World War II hit, It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Again, it seems pretty innocuous to us, and this is not communicating overtly evil messages, but nevertheless was their way of saying, hey, we're going to borrow from something popular so that we can create excitement in our time. Now, really quickly, once the jazz age came, some of us, and that would be us fundamentalists, said, whoa, 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 whoa. We're not going into that. And so what happened is that fundamentalists then split off of the rest of evangelicalism. The rest of evangelicalism continued to adopt any popular culture that came along the way. Fundamentalists said, no, we're not going into that because that music expresses some really bad stuff. And they were right, and I'm thankful that they did that. But now that's left us really with three distinct traditions. The Judeo-Christian tradition that we've been talking about, the fundamentalist tradition that split from that Judeo-Christian tradition for the most part, but stopped with the Jazz Age. We don't want to go any further. And the rest of evangelicalism, which today, as you know, will use just about anything, including rap, to communicate the gospel. So what do we do in closing? Where does that leave us? Well, I'll conclude with a couple brief suggestions. Number one, recognize the importance of form. That's what we lost. We said, hey, you know, it was good motivation. We want to see people saved. But in that, we lost our knowledge of what form does. And we failed to see that the forms developing in popular culture were expressing things that did not fit with Christian sentiment. Number two, learn to distinguish between forms that nurture noble affection and forms that excite base passions. That's also a significant difference. Remember, one of the characteristics before the Enlightenment was modesty. All the church leaders said, we don't want to just rouse people up. That's not worship. But today, for most people, that's what they see as worship, a rousing excitement. And so we're going to use any music that we can to rouse people up, to get them excited. We need to learn to distinguish between those two and choose those things that are nurturing right expression of affection to God that has been elicited by encounter with the true and living God. Number three, commit to cultivating the forms of the Judeo-Christian tradition. This is why Pastor Stikes has led us to predominantly draw from that tradition. Do we draw from other traditions as well? We do, because there is some good that comes from it. But majority of what we sing comes from this Judeo-Christian tradition. Again, not tradition for its own sake, but tradition because we have to have a blueprint, so we might as well take that from the crucible, the petri dish of Christian values instead of pagan values, and because as we look at that tradition and the characteristics of that tradition, we see that it fits with the values of the Scriptures. And then finally, I'll close with this, and this is what we're doing this week with Music Camp. Commit to passing this tradition to our children. If we don't pass this on to our children, folks, it will end with us. There are some who are still preserving that historic Christian tradition. There are some. It's very, very few. But it's going to be none unless we pass this on to our children. That's why this week in Music Camp, we're going to be teaching our children hymns from the medieval period. This is why we have our children in our worship with us, so that they can experience this kind of tradition for themselves firsthand. If we don't pass this on to our children, it will stop. I want to end with one quick thing. Is there no one preserving and writing in the Judeo-Christian tradition today? Yes, there is. There are a few. And I want to end with just a small clip from one of them. Probably, I don't know everyone who's writing everything, but probably the one who is writing the most, and this is a tune writer, so there are some texts being written as well, but the one who is writing the most tunes today that I would say fit within the Judeo-Christian tradition but are also moving and developing further is a music director in Philadelphia named Paul Jones. He's a music director at 10th Presbyterian Church. He's written a lot of excellent tunes. And I just want to end on a positive note because this is not all bleak and terrible. We can continue the tradition. That doesn't mean we're stuck in the medieval age by any means. We draw from that. We become familiar with that blueprint, and then we begin to write our own blueprints. And that's our goal. I want to end with a hymn by Paul Jones. There's a clip from it. It's called Give Praise to God. I want you to notice how it sounds like it fits in the tradition, but also in the harmonies and some of what he's done in the music, it definitely is fresh and new in terms of its development. And we'll close with a little bit of this. Some of the harmonies he was using would have never been used during the Reformation and medieval time. They weren't known. They're fresh. They're new. It still fits within that tradition. It's text-driven. It's modest. And it's distinct from the pagan culture around us. And as we, as Bethany Bible Church, want to worship the Lord, that's what's at stake here, right? expressing our affections to God as we encounter Him with truth in His Word. We're going to choose those hymns whose forms express those things best. And the best way to find that is to draw from that blueprint, to draw from that tradition that has been handed down to us, to pass that on to our children, and then hopefully to see that nurtured and cultivated and developed into the future. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the rich heritage that we have. We thank you for commands in your word that we are supposed to honor those who have come before us, that we are supposed to pay attention to the tradition that has been handed down to us, as Paul tells us in Corinthians. I pray that you would give us, through this survey, a burden to see the importance of doing that. That instead of taking our cues from the value systems of this world, we should take our cues from those godly Christians who had accountability and desire to express noble virtues that have come before us. Help us to see the importance of drawing from that tradition and then moving forward, passing it on to our children, and praying to see those forms nurtured and developed so that we can see produced good hymnody that is text-driven, modest, and distinct from pagan culture, all for your glory, all because we truly want to worship you in spirit and truth. We pray these things in the name of Christ. Amen.